amazing. So many people come here and don't know what I'm going to talk about. And a lot of the time, neither do I. But this evening I do. Because even though no one asked me as I was coming in here or just beforehand to give a talk on a particular topic, there was something which was in my mind. Because many of you know, last week, last Friday, I was still in England. My mother died, so I went for the funeral. But it's not about death or dying. I've given so many talks about that. While I was in UK, you know, on those aircraft for so many hours, you pick up the newspapers and read what's going on. You know, probably read everything in the newspaper because you got a bit bored sometimes. But something caught my attention. Right now in UK, there is a big debate on gay marriage. And, I mean, this is much hotter than it is here in Australia. And at the same time, I got back, and apparently the government of Australia are now seeking the input from Buddhist leaders and other religious leaders on gay marriage. So this evening, I am going to be talking about the Buddhist views on marriage, especially gay marriage, but not just to say a view, but also to use this as a means of discovering how Buddhists make these moral decisions. And there's actually the place of things like marriage, you know, in this Buddhist tradition. And, you know, exactly whether, I'm going to start off by saying, whether that what you hear from a monk like me is actually representative of the Buddhist tradition. Because a couple of months ago, there was a conference here in Perth. It wasn't that well attended. It was in Murdoch University. And I was listening to one of the professors of Murdoch who was giving a presentation about Buddhism. And one of the things he was saying, he said, especially in our Western world, he said, you know, you think that Buddhism is so liberal and so modern and so compassionate, but that's not real traditional Buddhism. And traditional Buddhism, he's saying, was more conservative. And I know that that may be the view of some academics, but that is totally wrong. And you may think that I am a very modern liberal monk, you know, doing things like ordaining bhikkhunis and, you know, speaking up for gays earlier on. I must confess that one of the proudest moments in my life here in Australia was when I did write a letter to our local newspaper criticising, of all people, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, because there was an article in the newspaper reporting that the Dalai Lama had said you can't be a Buddhist and be gay at the same time. And when I read that, I thought, that's not right, that's wrong. And so I write to the local paper to say, no, I'm afraid he's obviously been quoted out of context. You can be a Buddhist, you can be gay, there's nothing wrong at all. Traditional Buddhism allows that, there's no problem whatsoever in any which way. And as a result of that, my prize for standing up for the gay community in Perth was to get my invitation to the Gay Pride Breakfast. Thank you so much. So I went along to the Gay Pride Breakfast. I was so proud to go there. It's good fun, because when I went there, you know what I'm like. Always have good fun wherever you go. So when I went there, you know, I'm not gay. And I told them, look, I'm not gay. I'm not straight. I'm weirder than the lot of you. I'm celibate. So just having good fun. But, you know, I'm winning. So traditionally, look, I am not just like a monk who changes Buddhism to suit the Western world. I study Buddhism to its heart, you know, just the learning Pali, seeing the ancient scriptures, reading them, understanding them, translating them, especially the rules of discipline for the monks. There you really get to understand how the Buddha thought. And to understand that traditional, real traditional Buddhism, and I'm not talking about the Buddhism of Thailand or Burma or Sri Lanka, I'm talking much earlier than that. From the time of the Buddha, that Buddhism, the most traditional, the earliest Buddhism, was so compassionate, kind, and tolerant. And that's why we have our monastic rules, which is so compassionate, so kind, and so tolerant. And when it comes to something like marriage, one of the things I noticed, I was just writing a little article about this, is marriage existed before all these religions came along. No, before Christianity came along, Islam, Judaism, you know, before Buddhism came along even, there were still people getting married. We're not quite sure what those ceremonies were. There might have been some spiritual sort of element to it, but marriage was there before religion came along. But what happens sometimes, religion comes along, sees something which it can adopt and get a bit of leverage out of and make it a sacrament or make it sacred. And apparently that's what happened with marriage. But not Buddhism never did that. It recognized marriage but never tried to govern it or control it. Saying, if two people want to get married, fine. We will support you, but we won't make any rules about who marries who. Except for the point, I must say, that there was, and this is earliest Buddhism, to say that, you know, you shouldn't get married to someone who's really underage or someone who is, like, mentally incompetent to give, you know, what we call informed consent. Or someone who's maybe your servant or slave who is, again, not really free to make informed consent. That was actually as far as it went. In other words, you know, rules which we would say today are basic human rights, recognized in even the earliest times, and that was as far as you would go. There was nothing about not having interreligious or interracial or in India, intercaste marriages. So if two people wanted to get married, fine, off you go. And the job of religion in Buddhism was not to try and say who would marry who, but to say, here it is, this happens in this world, now how can we support that? How can we make it a happy, a good marriage? So that's where religions like Buddhism came along and gave it that spiritual uplift to make sure that the two people who got married were going to have a happy, good time. Because it's not easy getting married. Well, actually, it's easy getting married, but staying married, that's a tough one. And so that's why the Buddhism gave all these incredible, beautiful teachings to help marriage. In other words, and you know, with Dennis sitting over there, you know, he's the Buddhist Society marriage celebrant, you know, with Jill Hannah. Anyone else who wants to become a Buddhist marriage celebrant, please come up, because, you know, we need more. But I do the spiritual side of it. And because I've been giving marriage blessings and talking to these people for such a long time now, you do recognize there's a very powerful, strong spiritual message there. It's not just signing the paper. Those of you who've been through a marriage or seen a marriage know there's something very powerful and deep happening between those two people. It's a spiritual dimension, and that is why even today we always have some spiritual, not always, but people want to have some spiritual or religious input into this ceremony which they're holding in front of their family and friends. And I know that it's not just a commitment. I know that sort of some of the arguments I saw reading in the newspaper said, oh, the gays, we can have a civil marriage, like a civil contract. Yeah, you can have a civil contract to, you know, with the bank to pay your mortgage over the next 30 years. But it's something very, very different from just having a contract saying, now I'm going to be your husband or your partner for the next so many years. It's something very different there. And you know that, those of you who have been married or been in that moment, you know, in that ceremony. Sometimes you can't live up to the inspiration of the ceremony, but it's there, you remember it, and it's something which is very spiritual. Use the word spiritual rather than religious, because sometimes religious has got a bad name now, so we use spiritual. It means basically the same thing without the bad connotations. So there's something spiritual about that moment. And, you know, I'm a celibate monk. You know, I'm like the referee, you know, on the outside. So I can actually sort of see just how the two sides play this important part of their life. And to see, you know, what it really is doing is something which in Buddhism we come so very close to this non-self idea and renunciation, letting go of your personal control. Because being by yourself, you can control what you do and how you do and when you do it. But when you enter into relationship, you have to relinquish a lot of that control. In other words, you can't think about yourself anymore. And, as I often say, you've heard it here, I say this in all the marriages, you can't think of your partner either. In a marriage, you should never think of yourself. In a marriage, you must never think of your partner. In a marriage, you just think of us. There is a jump there. A jump from the ordinary, from the mundane, into something much more uplifting, spiritual, something which is, in Buddhism, much more selfless. Now, first of all, I mention this because these are the two mistakes of a marriage. First of all, you know, what I'm getting out of it, that's the selfish part of the marriage. In Buddhism, we call that the Hinayana marriage. This is just a little bit of basic Buddhism. Two types of Buddhism, they say, Hinayana, Mahayana. Hinayana is when you're just meditating, you're practicing for your own enlightenment, to hell with everybody else. So my meditation, I'm going on a retreat, don't disturb me, I don't want any business or any duties, just I'm going to live in the cave, you feed me, Luke, look after me because I'm going for enlightenment. That's the so-called concern just about me. The other Mahayana is where you sacrifice everything for other people. You sacrifice even your own enlightenment. All the other blades of grass become enlightened before me. I may be the very last. And I also have some very funny stories about that because, you know, this is what we call the Bodhisattva. The idea of sacrificing yourself for all other beings. And I had a story once. I'm just rambling again. When I was a school teacher. Only for 1 year, because if you ever teach high school for 1 year, you'll all think of becoming a monk or a nun. Anything to get away from those kids. So I was a school teacher for 1 year. At the end of the year, I had to give out the report cards. This was about 40 years ago. And, of course, one of the kids in my class came last, bottom of the class. And as soon as I gave the report cards, I was looking at him. He opened his report card and he saw 30th in a class of 30. He could see his face drop, his shoulders drop. Oh, God, what am I going to tell my parents this evening? The guy was showing very clear signs of clinical depression. And I was always a kind, innovative person, even as a school teacher. I couldn't just allow this kid to get so upset and have so much suffering. So I went to speak with him. They all knew I was a Buddhist when I was a school teacher. I even taught meditation sort of in the assembly for 5 days. But that's another story. But I went up to him and I said, listen, I'm going to teach you some Buddhism about the concept of the Bodhisattva. In Buddhism, a Bodhisattva is one of the highest revered beings. They are someone who sacrifices their own happiness out of concern for others. He said, that's you. You have voluntarily taken this worst position in the whole class, the whole bottom, knowing just how much suffering you're saving your classmates. So by taking this lowly position of 30th, the bottom of the class, it means that your friends don't have to get told off by their parents this evening. Only you do that. I know that you've done this on purpose because you're the Bodhisattva. I'm going to recommend you to the headmaster to get this year's Bodhisattva prize. All these other kids in the class, they're just thinking of themselves. But you thought of others. Well done. And when he looked at me, he looked as if I was crazy. But he laughed. It just took away that negativity of being bottom. But I did add one thing at the end before I left him. I said, but in this school, you're only allowed to get the Bodhisattva prize once. So let someone else become bottom next year. But that's the idea of a Bodhisattva. Sacrifice your own happiness for the sake of other beings. And that in a marriage, sometimes that's a Mahayana. You sacrifice yourself for your partner. That doesn't work, does it? You get burnt out. There's nothing in it for you. You get sort of, why am I doing all this to this guy or this girl all the time? That is not the way of a Buddhist marriage. It's not about me. selfishness. It's not about sacrificing myself for my partner. It's about losing yourself in the relationship, losing yourself, renouncing me for us. Not me, not him, not her, but us. That is why it becomes spiritual. And it's not trusting the other person. It's not trusting yourself. It's trusting the relationship, the us part of things. That is why when I look at these relationships, you know, which really make something and really last and grow, you see that, you know, sometimes you look at the couple and you know, it's not sort of Ainsley, it's not Barbara. It's as they say these days, Barb Ainsley. It's like you can't imagine one without the other. What's actually happening there is there is an usness to this relationship. And that usness is part of that spirituality. You know, we're looking at something which is not belonging to a person, but belonging to the relationship. And as I mentioned here so often, the whole spiritual path is about the relationship you have with life, with sickness, with disappointment, with happiness. It's not happiness and misery, things going right, things going wrong, or my life being busy or having time off. It's my relationship with being busy, my relationship with having time off, my relationship when things go really well in our Buddhist society, my relationship when things go difficult. That is the spiritual path. Because, you know, I've really worked hard over all these years trying to make a beautiful Buddhist society, when it always goes wrong. And then it goes right. And then there's another problem, and you fix it, and you have peace and happiness for a while, and then something else goes wrong. Isn't that the same with your life? Even as a monk, you can't escape from that. So in a monastery or in the world, it's not trying to control, you know, the externals and making everything so perfect and so wonderful so you can relax and just have a good time forever and ever, amen. No, what it is perfecting the relationship you have with things, with life, with your body, with sickness, with the death of my mother. It's not the death of my mother, it's how I relate to that. It's not sort of, you know, your kid getting expelled from the Dharma school, it's how you relate to that experience. That is where, you know, sort of the Buddhism lies. And that's why in a marriage, that's why there's something very spiritual there, because it's not about the people anymore. The relationship is the big thing in a marriage. That is why it is spiritual. But because Buddhism recognized that that's a spirituality, and we don't like governing anything in Buddhism, even your precepts, you're given there, keep them, don't keep them, that's totally up to you. You know that in some places, you know that if you misbehave, you would never be allowed to come here. I remember once, I'd just given the 5 precepts and made this fellow a full member of our Buddhist society, and then somebody gave me a clipping from the newsletter, from the newspaper. This guy who had taken the 5 precepts, become a member of our Buddhist society, was in a prominent court case for fraud. And he got into court, apparently, dressed in Arab gear, like, you know, like Lawrence of Arabia, you know, with flowing gowns, you know, in the Supreme Court here in Perth. And he said, after the judge had said, you know, you should sort of dress appropriately when you come into court, and he said, I will consult with my spiritual leaders in Serpentine. Oh, my God, I'm in trouble now. So the guy was a bit crazy, and I'd just given him the 5 precepts, for goodness sake. But we talked about it and said, no, the guy's welcome here. And we're not going to judge and only have, you know, people we can be proud of or good. Anybody can come in here. Look, I remember when I first went to Thailand 38 years ago, I was staying in a temple over in Bangkok. And I never got this invite, but they told me they'd just been a few weeks before to Pat Pong Road, the monks. For those of you who don't know Bangkok, Pat Pong Road was the red light district of Bangkok. every year, at least in those days, you know, these were prostitutes. They would clean up their premises, dress appropriately, because we monks are very sensitive, and invite the monks to do an alms offering. You know, they wanted to make good karma as well. You know, feed the monks, you know, take the precepts for the day, and then just, you know, make some charitable donations to the temple. You know, the monks would never look down upon that. They'd never say, no, we're not going to you harlots, you Jezebels, you sinners or whatever. No, these were people. And we don't care what you do in your life. That's your business. We are always going to be kind and generous and help you. And that really inspired me as a Westerner coming to a Buddhist country for the first time. There was not this discrimination and judgment and you're good, you're bad because you do this and you do that. I don't know why people get in those professions or why they do that. It'd be great if they didn't. But, you know, sometimes you talk to people and just the situations they're put in their life. I got a letter from one girl. She had to become a prostitute because to pay off her father's gambling debts. That's what she said. She was in a very, very difficult time. So sometimes, how can you be so judgmental? And it's great that Buddhism never was that judgmental. And hopefully this Buddhist society is never going to be judgmental. Whoever wants to come in here, come in. As long as you behave while you're in here, and then fine. So because it's not so judgmental, this is, you know, initial Buddhism. This is why the relationship we have with with everybody is the most important part. And that's why the marriage is very, very spiritual. But without governing the marriage. By governing, I mean putting all these rules and saying, okay, if you're a Buddhist, you can only marry other Buddhists. That is something which really riles me. Because I know many people who have very different faiths. And when they meet together and they get married, sometimes they enhance the relationship because they're different. Sometimes they see things from a different angle, and when they actually see things from a different angle, basically, say it's a Christian marries a Buddhist, the Christian keeps the Buddhist honest. If it's two Buddhists together, I mean, they just support each other's delusions, basically. But the Christian would always be saying, you're not being a good Buddhist, you know, you're getting angry. That's not good Buddhism. I'm saying, oh, yeah. I think you know that. So it's great having someone who's not a Buddhist as your partner because they make you better Buddhists. They're always on your tail. And it's the same with a Christian. And the Buddhists say, you're not being compassionate. You know, remember what Jesus said, turn the other cheek? Come on, turn the other cheek. I'm going to slap it for you. And yes, sometimes it's enriching to have differences coming together. Now, personally, as a monk, I have developed friendships between non-Buddhists. Even just last Sunday, you know, it was at St. George's Cathedral, just for an interfaith conference. I go every once a year. And now you get to be friends with these people. You guys have some really nice discussions, discussions which I can never have with Buddhists. You can have with Christians because, you know, they ask me questions you guys would never ask me. And I really value that. So we don't put rules on people to say, okay, Buddhists, you can only marry Buddhists. Buddhists who come to this temple, you can't marry the Buddhists who go to the other temple, you know, over in Guildford Road. No, you can't marry them. We don't do that. And isn't that beautiful? Marriage is, you choose, it's up to you, who you're going to live with. The job of your teachers, priests, whatever you want to call us, are monks and nuns. Our job is to help you. In other words, to support, not to tell you what to do, but to give you some advice on how to do it better. That's all. That's with marriage, and that's also with gay marriage. There is nothing which I can see in the teachings of the Buddha which prevent that. And there's every reason why it should be permitted and celebrated. Why? It's because I've seen between two gay men, two gay women, that they see the same sort of that love and that inspiration of wanting to say, I want to give up myself in this relationship with you. I want it not to be about me anymore. I don't want it to be about you. I want it to be about us. I'm going to abandon you know, what I want to do, where I want to do it, because I want to have this relationship with you. If they're two males or two females, I don't care what it is. I can see exactly the same. And for me, that is the essence of a marriage. It's a relationship two people have together. And it does not have to be between male and female. That is one of the reasons, if ever you've seen and had friends or had children, you know, who are gay, and you see them having these beautiful relationships, you know, with their partner, and sometimes you say, why are we stopping them expressing, you know, their sort of love together and their spirituality of renouncing what they want? Why can't we celebrate this in a ceremony between other people, in front of other people, in a marriage ceremony? Because I can't see any reason why not. And certainly in Buddhism, there is no reason from the Buddha, from the scriptures, to prevent this. You say, why not? And that question, why not, is very, very strong. It's not going to destroy society. Society gets destroyed when people try and control us too much. Society gets destroyed when we discriminate too much, that I am better than you or I'm different than you, and in the sense of being better or being worse. The Buddha taught this beautiful teaching. This is traditional deep Buddhism, the three conceits. If you haven't heard this before, sometimes when I first heard this, it blew my mind. Because I thought conceit was, I'm better than you. And that's the first of the three conceits. I am better. I am the monk. I sit up here and I teach you every day. That's conceit. The second conceit is, I'm worse than you. I'm really hopeless. I should get a proper job. You know, instead of sitting up here eating all your food, I could do much more. Maybe I should go, you know, go to the Centrelink and apply for sort of job or study or something. That's thinking you're worse than somebody else. That's also called conceit. And the third conceit is thinking I'm the same as everybody else. Whoa. Because I thought that's what we're supposed to do. We're all the same. That is a conceit. We're not the same. No one's better. No one's worse. Just different, that's all. That's a beautiful conceit. The three conceits. And the answer is, there's no two people in this room which are totally even, exactly the same. Hopefully that never, ever happens. Everybody's different. Not better, not worse. Not the same. Just totally unique. And beautiful in that uniqueness, just adding to the beautiful texture of our world. I've been living in forests most of my life because we're forest monks. I've never, ever seen two trees exactly the same, but I've seen millions of trees. I've never seen a tree which is better or worse. Not the same, just different. And that makes the forest beautiful. That's why in life, when we see just people from all different parts of life, even prisoners, even saints, the whole works, welcome everybody to life. You are totally welcome to this life. Thank you so much for coming. You are honored guest in life. Once one understands what we're talking about, that those three conceits, why is it that sometimes we discriminate? That just because of your sexual orientation, because of your colour of your skin, because of your gender, because of your age, why is it we discriminate? It doesn't make any sense. And the Buddha never, ever did that. In fact, when I went to this service last Sunday at St. George's Cathedral, I had to sort of say something about discrimination. And what the Buddha has taught about discrimination. I quoted one of the ancient sutras, the Asukari Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya, where it says, look, you don't say you're better or worse because you come from a rich family or a poor family, high class, low caste, educated or non-educated. That doesn't make you better or worse. It's what you do in your life. The kindness, the virtue, the generosity, that is what makes a person. Not sort of where they come from or the colour of their skin or their sexual orientation. It's their compassion and kindness and goodness. That is what's really important in life. So because there was not that discrimination, now you think, why is there any discrimination between gays being married? and other people being married. There should not be. In Buddhism, there is no discrimination there at all. And I think it would be a wonderful thing for society. It would be a wonderful thing for my friends I know who are gay, for them to be standing up here with Dennis and myself doing the marriage service for them. I'd love that. Why? Because I would be supporting members of our community in their celebration of a relationship together. And I'd be getting rid of some of these discrimination which hurts people so much. One of the reasons I got involved in such issues was I was giving a talk. It used to be called Mercy Hospital. It's St. Anne's. What's that hospital called now? It's, you know, by the river. Is it Mercy? It's Mercy. I think it was called St. Anne's Hospital before. I was giving a talk. I give a talk, you know, all over the place. But there's times when you give a talk when somebody comes up to you and they say something which you never forget. And I'll keep this to the end of my days. This guy came up. He was maybe in his 60s, maybe early 70s. He was getting on. And he said to me, he said, I'm a leader of the gay community. And he said, religion has been so harsh on us, so cruel to us over the years. And when he saw that, he just opened his heart to all the pain he'd felt over those years. And that was a catalytic point in my life. He said, look, that's not good enough. Anybody, any human being who experiences such pain and discrimination, I will stand up for them. Why not? So what Buddhism does, Buddhism takes the principles. We don't have like the hard and fast rules about this is right, this is wrong. It's how do you find out it's right? How do you find out it's wrong? What is the way that you can make these decisions whether gay marriages should be happen or should not be happen? Number one, please, please, please don't go looking in the books all the time. I keep on saying it is the books which stand in the way of truth. Never let your learning stand in the way of truth. Truth is right there in front of you. You feel it, you know it, and you look in the books and it says that this is wrong. But you know it's not wrong because you feel it's right. You know it's right. You don't need to have a PhD in psychology to know in your heart what is right and what is wrong. So a lot of the time, I just look inside and you feel it. You don't think it, you feel it. Now, is this right? Is this wrong? And every time I look inside, it feels that this is the right thing to do. The other thing with books, remember what I said about books, the difference between the container and the contents? The container and the contents, sometimes we make the mistake. We think the container is the contents. That's why when people go burning Qurans, they shouldn't do that. But what does the Quran say inside? Be merciful. So if someone goes burning a book or blowing up a Buddha statue, Buddha statues are the containers. The books are the containers. What does that Buddha statue teach us? It teaches us to forgive, to let go, to be kind, to be gentle, to be compassionate. So when we mistake the container for the contents, we kill people because they blew up a Buddha statue. We actually blow up Buddhism that way. The contents are much more important than the container. Now, what did the Prophet Muhammad teach? What did Jesus teach? What did the Buddha teach? What's the contents? If we look at what the books are actually teaching us, rather than just look at the cover and worship the cover, then we'd actually know what I say, the difference between the container and the contents. The truth is in your heart there. The books are supposed to teach you how to find that truth. Not what that truth is. When you know that, you can feel that this is the right thing to do. And you know, after a while, when you trust in that heart there, you know that it's the most reliable indicator of what's right and what's wrong, what you feel inside. So that's actually how the Buddhists, you know, make these moral decisions. They look inside. does it feel right? And a lot of times that's 100% accurate. And then you can start understanding why it's right. Now, what is this meaning of life? It is to develop our kindness and compassion. And again, this selflessness. So we let go of our own, what we want, what's good for me, what I want myself, for something bigger and greater. That's where we lose ourselves in something bigger. That is spirituality. And that is what can happen in a relationship, in a marriage. And that's why we celebrate it. And that's why it's so beautiful. And I'm trying to keep these talks to 45 minutes. And it's been quite a serious talk so far. And so now, I know you're all waiting for this. And now, this particular joke, I've told some of you privately before, but I don't think I've had the nerve to say this on a Friday night, because it's about gay lifestyle, sort of. But nevertheless, it's such a funny joke. Please excuse me if I offend anybody, but I don't mind, because tomorrow morning early I'm leaving. I'm going out of the country, so I think I'll be safe. But it is the story of the rabbit, the bear, and the magic duck. Some of you know this, so you're laughing. It's a very, very funny story. Once there was a rabbit and a bear and a magic duck. And one day the bear was chasing the rabbit again, making such a noise. And when they passed the lake where the magic duck lived, the magic duck said, "Stop it, you two. You're creating so much noise and disturbance to the tranquility of this beautiful forest." "Look," said the magic duck, "I'm a magic duck. I will give you 3 wishes each if you promise me never to chase each other again." And the bear looked at the rabbit, and the rabbit looked at the bear, and they nodded, "Okay." So they promised never to chase each other again. And so the rabbit, the magic duck said, "Okay, Mr. Bear, your first choice. What's your first wish?" And the bear, being a male, an alpha male, said, "You know, there's too much competition in this forest. My first wish is all the other bears in this forest are all female, and I'm the only male." You know what guys are like, girls? So the magic duck said, "Well, if that's what you wish, fine." "Quack," said the magic duck. And at that quack, all the bears in that whole forest were all female. He was the only male. Woo-hoo-hoo, what fun. And then they asked the rabbit, "What's your first wish?" And the rabbit said, "I want a motorcycle helmet." And the magic duck said, "What does a rabbit want with a crash helmet?" And the rabbit said, "Look, I don't have to explain why. You gave me a wish. Give it to me." "Okay," said magic duck. Quack. And a motorcycle helmet appeared on top of this rabbit. Second wish to the bear. "Mr. Bear, what's your second wish?" And Mr. Bear said, "I've been thinking, you know, as soon as the other bears in the other regions of this country hear there's only females up here, they'll all come up here and spoil my fun. So my second wish is may all the bears in the whole country be female. And I'm the only male in the whole, not just this forest, the whole country. I'm the only male bear, so I can have lots and lots of fun." "Okay," said magic duck. Quack. And all the bears in the whole country were all female. The only male. Imagine that, you guys. And then they asked the rabbit, "What's your second wish?" And the rabbit said, "I want a Harley Davidson, 1,000 cc's, to go with my crash helmet." "I can understand that," said the duck. So quack. And this beautiful Harley, you know, gleaming new, 1,000 cc's with all the trimmings, appeared. And so, wearing his crash helmet, the duck got on his Harley and started revving it up. Oh, it was great, you know, having a Harley, a new one. "Okay, Mr. Bear, what's your third wish?" And Mr. Bear said, "Now I've been thinking, I should have done this first of all. I was a bit slow and tired out by chasing this stupid rabbit. But as soon as all the male bears overseas hear there's only females here, they get on boats, you know, from Indonesia or whatever, and they'll come here." So my third wish, should have been my first, my third wish, may all the bears in the whole world in the whole world be female, and I'm the only male bear in the whole world, so I'd have no competition at all. Okay, said the magic duck, quack. And at that third quack, amazingly, all the bears in the whole world were female. He was the only male bear. And then to the rabbit, your last wish. And he was on his motorbike, revving up for a quick getaway. My third wish, magic duck, is that Mr. Bear is gay. Quack. So I know some of you have heard that before, but that's a great little joke to end with about gay marriage talk. So that is one of the ways which Buddhism celebrates life and also celebrates gay marriage, straight marriage, whatever marriage you want. Again, it's why not? And also the important part of the marriage is the relationship. That's a spiritual part of it, and that's why I'm very happy to come and just bless marriages, and why I feel it's, please come, let's get religion which controls out of the way and give people the freedom and the support. If they're going to do it, let's do it well. Not just a contract, you know, just like buying a car. It's much more than that, and it should be recognised it's more than that. And I really empathise with any gay couples who think, when is it going to happen that we can give that spiritual dimension to our marriage, and religion will allow us. Buddhism does allow you. It's the government. It's the one which is standing in opposition. So any government people listening to this, and I know a few senators do listen to these talks, please see if you can at least give the freedom for Buddhists. Other religions can make their own choice, but I think Buddhists should have the freedom. If they want religious gay marriages, they should have the opportunity to do so. So thank you for listening. And I do apologise if I offended anyone with that stupid joke. So any questions anyone has? I know we usually get some questions over the internet, so I'm expecting a question from Rome, from the Pope, this evening. That'd be good, wouldn't it? So maybe have some questions from the floor before we get the internet questions. Yeah. Okay, you are saying that why do we always discriminate? And you're saying the main reason is because we just follow what other people say. We just follow our parents, we follow our teachers, we follow the people who influence us a lot. Exactly, that's why I get very scared about sitting up here telling you what to believe. So it's very nice, and I know you've done this before. You've argued with me, and that gives me a lot of relief. Because if people don't argue with me and say, I don't agree with you, Ajahn Brahm, that makes me very worried. Because the last thing I want to do is to become like another pope, like another person who tells you what to believe. Instead, again, teaching you how to think is more important than teaching you how to believe, what to believe. So again, like you question it deeply. And the best thing, as I said, feel it in the heart, what's right, what's wrong. And if you feel it in the heart, you know that that's right to allow such a thing. Because part of my job is anywhere where you see people being hurt, discriminated against, and you can do something about it, you try and do something. Sometimes you're unable to do anything about it, but here I think we can. So, yes, Mr. President. Oh, yeah, talking about gay marriage, that includes lesbian marriage, yes, of course. Now, gay, lesbian, transsexual, but it's, you know, sometimes that it's hard to get all the words out, so just gay and the others as well. That's what I really meant. That's very good. Yes? Would a gay marriage or lesbian marriage throw a different light if it involves children? I think that gay people have been, and lesbian people have been bringing up children. Single parents have been bringing up children. And I think that the evidence has been amassing that it does not... Well, basically, that single parents bringing up children or gay parents bringing up children have done a terrific job. It's not whether you're gay, whether you're straight, whether you are a single parent. It's how you bring up the children. That's the most important indicator of success and in the raising of children. So look, I mean, as many have children have been raised by parents and they've been in abusive relationships with their parents, or rather parents have abused their kids. So it doesn't, I don't think it's really that important about whether it's a same-sex couple raising a kid or a different-sex couple or a single parent. It's how they do that is more important. So there'll be a different dynamic there, for sure. But it does not mean to be a dynamic which is going to hinder the child in any way. Maybe the child who comes from a same-sex marriage and is raised by same-sex parents, maybe they can become far more tolerant in our society, far more tolerant of differences between religions, races, sexual orientations, cultures. Maybe they do become more tolerant beings when they grow up. I don't know, it's interesting. I can't see any reason why there should be a great difference, except just the way that that same-sex couple or the way the different-sex couple raises their kids. It's how they do it, not actually who does it.
Yeah, well, we think that it's an expression of the desire.
It's expression of the same-sex couple's desire, not their need. You know that sometimes it's very hard to distinguish between desires and needs. You know, whether even different sex couples, whether they really have a need to bring in a kid into the relationship or whether it's a desire. If it is a desire, it's sometimes a very noble desire. Some people ask me that, sort of, is it a good thing for a Buddhist to bring a child into this world when there's already so many human beings in this world, when the world is overpopulated? Is it a good thing to do? But then again, opposite to that, we have the Buddhist teaching, this human life is such a precious life, it's such a beautiful life. And so you're giving another being a chance to come into this world. And so, I mean, there are many orphans in this world, many kids who don't have parents. Would it be better for those orphans to be in some sort of institution or to be with loving parents, even if those parents are of the same gender? If they receive beautiful love? It's a complicated question, but I cannot really see the difference between the desire and the need there. Yes? The definitions. You're asking, how do you get around the definition that marriage in the dictionary is between a man and a woman? Should you use a different word? Some time ago, the definition of religion was belief in a supreme being, which made Buddhism not a religion at all, which meant that many of the benefits of religion, like, you know, tax exemption, like being able to do marriage services, and many of the other benefits which were offered to other religions were not available to things like Buddhism. And I remember I should have kept a copy of this. It was a brilliant debate in the House of Lords in England about, you know, was Buddhism a religion? And it was that High Court judge in England, Christmas Humphreys, you know, he gave the argument which convinced, you know, the House of Lords in this very beautiful, high-powered argument, not like in, unfortunately to say, the, you know, the Senate in Australia where they just, you know, slang each other all the time. This was a real debate, a very good argument, where the power of the argument was more important than who was saying it. So you weren't talking about the people, you're a stupid idiot or whatever. It was the argument was paramount in this debate. And they came to the conclusion that Buddhism qualified as a religion, but the only way they could do that was to change the definition of religion, which they did. So these words are, like anything else, anicca, impermanent. The meaning of words does change with time. Even the word gay. 50 years ago, I could have said I had a gay weekend, and no one would have looked at me askance and say, my goodness, you know, you've got a partner who's a man. A gay means just, you know, gay and carefree, had a happy time. So even the word gay has changed in the dictionary. So why should marriage not also be subject to change in definition as our culture evolves? Every other word changes. Why? Religion changes definition. The word gay changes definition. What's so special about this word marriage? One of the things I'm really concerned about, I don't want any religion, especially Buddhism or any other religions, to actually to control marriage, to have power over it. You should have power over marriage, not a religion. You give it meaning, not me or not some pope or archbishop. Unfortunately, you guys and girls, you've given that power to religion. We decide what marriage is. I don't think that's correct. Anyway, here we've got two questions from overseas. First of all, Rui from Portugal. Hope I pronounced that right. Ajahn, what is the Buddhist way for a couple to deal with your kids' tantrums and misbehaving? Good, that's why I became a monk, so I didn't have to answer that question. Okay, I mean, look for modern psychology, because that's such a huge question there. You know, why are they doing tantrums? Why are they misbehaving? And it could be because sometimes it's because they're sick, physically sick. Sometimes it's because they're having a hard time at school. Sometimes it could be, you know, some means of trying to get your attention because you're not spending enough time with them. So there's so many different ways. So that's just too big a question to actually answer. But I would say, in brief, a Buddhist way is to investigate, first of all. Find out why. What's the cause of these things? So I know that's a hard thing when the kid is playing around right in front of you. But, you know, try and find some time to discover its cause. Maybe it's not enough time with you. Why are they sort of misbehaving? Sometimes see the doctor, psychologist, they may be able to assist you because you haven't got as much time as you can. Find out why. And of course, always be kind and compassionate. Anyway, Karen, I'm not sure if I answered that question adequately, because that's just too huge a question for 2 minutes. And Karen from Holland, I see remarks about gay people grow. Children use the word gay instead of you stupid or something like that. What to do? Is that the case? And kids, I know that kids at school, sometimes they can be really, really mean. They see anything in another person, you know, which is slightly different, and they use that, you know, to tease them, to basically verbal bullying. And the thing to do, if children use the word gay instead of you stupid or something like that, kids are doing that to try and upset a person. And, you know, the usual, it depends on how old the kid is. The usual advice we give, if someone calls you a pig at school, go oink, 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 or whatever. In other words, don't get upset at it. If you get upset, the person who's criticizing you has won. Because they say bad things to you, like you're stupid or gay or whatever, they try and upset you. If you refuse to get upset, make a joke about it, because you refuse to get upset, because that means that the person who said that has lost. Their intention was to upset you, and you refuse to get upset. So, kids, if you can, doesn't matter what another person says to you, if you react with negativity, then that person has won. If you react making a joke about it, or whatever, then you've won. And they will stop ridiculing you anymore. So I've received a lot of ridicule in my time as a monk when people call me, you're dressed like a girl. And they did that to try and upset me, but I thought it was so funny I laughed, and they got upset. And they call you, yeah, you're stupid, Ajahn Brahm. That was a really stupid joke. They say, yeah, it was a stupid joke, wasn't it? I agree with you, but I don't get upset about it. Because a lot of times people try and pick on you, press the buttons to try and get a negative reaction, try and destroy your happiness. Never allow anyone to destroy your happiness. No matter what they say or what they do, you are in control of your happiness. Please remember that. It's your responsibility. What other people say, it says more about them than it ever says about you. If someone calls you gay, what's the old way we say, it takes one to know one. That's an old one. Like, you can get lots of reposts or whatever. So, again, it's a nice question, but it's a bit too deep. When you get only two lines of question here, I'm not sure if I answer it accurately or not, but certainly in this talk today, religion should be teaching people to be more loving. And loving means more accepting and more tolerant and empathizing with people who are suffering. And if people are suffering, religion should try and do something about it to ease their suffering out of compassion. And it doesn't hurt other people if gays get married. So off you go, please do so. And if the law ever gets changed, please come here. I'm sure that Dennis and I will be glad, be honoured to do the first Buddhist gay marriage in Australia. We did the first bhikkhuni ordination, so we want to sort of add to our reputation. Very good. Okay, thank you all for listening.